years, graduated from St. John's University, and after that I spent 2 years in China teaching English in a college and a high school. And a couple years after that, I decided to take this bike trip where we began in Beijing and we ended in Paris, France. And that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. Mr. Fekkonen had asked me to come in and talk a little bit about the bike trip and some of the things that we saw along the way. Now, I was, I might sit down so everyone can see okay, but I wasn't alone on this bike trip. There were four other people with me. They're all up there now. The first guy is Peter. After that, we have Adam.
This is from right to left.
Right.
Okay.
And Nakia. That's me. And the final guy is Andrew. We were all spiffed up in our biking gear and high visibility clothing, which was very helpful in the crazy traffic we encountered along the way. Now, you might ask, why did we ever decide to do something so crazy as to try to bike from Paris to, or sorry, from Beijing to Paris? Well, we had a couple different reasons. I think the first is that we all really like to bike, and we like to travel, and if you travel by biking, you can basically travel for free, because all of your expenses simply go to food. So you don't have to pay for transportation, you can camp every night, and so your costs are very low. And another reason we did this trip by bike is that we wanted to get a good idea of what a lot of the different countries in the world were like. Because you'll hear on the news, you know, if you watch the news, you're hearing mostly negative things, I think, about many different places in the world. That's just the way it works, you know. The bad news is what you're going to hear about. So you hear about a lot of crime, a lot of poverty, a lot of people being miserable. We wanted to see if the world is actually like that, or, you know, is it a little different from what you hear in the media. So we decided about a year before we started to do this trip. So that gave me about 1 year to find a bike, to save a little bit of money, and then in September 2007 we met in Beijing and started biking. Let's see, this is our complete route, but the first part of the trip was all in China. Part of the route started in Beijing and made our way down to Hong Kong. This is the first day of the trip. This is in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, China, the former...
Tiananmen Square, Beijing. Are you going to talk about what happened there in 89?
It's not really part of the...
Okay, let's make note. But 1989, we'll study this later.
Yes.
Something very important happened in this square in 1989.
Yes, and I guess... as part of that, I will just say, if you go to Tiananmen Square today, one of the funnest things to do is just to sit back, lean up against a tree, and find the plainclothes policeman. Because of what has happened here, it's become a very famous place to protest in China. But the Chinese government hates protesters, especially in their famous historical sites, especially in Tiananmen. So they have this place just covered with plainclothes policemen, and you can tell by their buzz cuts, their rather stocky build, and their seriousness. But we did not have time to do that while biking because we were busy. But China has a lot of people, and we were a veritable freak show while we were going through China, because we are all not Asian. We're all foreign, okay, from the Chinese perspective. We all have big noses, we all have lighter colored hair, and, you know, Peter is 6'7". I'm about 6 foot tall. When I go around China by myself in smaller villages, people will look at me and say, oh, so tall, walk down the street, and it'll just be, ah, nama gao. Just people can't believe how tall I am. So, of course, with Peter, they were especially amazed. And we have Nakia, who is black. You don't see too many black people in China. She was an enigma for a lot of people. And Adam and Andrew both have blonde hair. So they were especially amazing for the Chinese. Well, we decided to bring instruments with us as well, because we were all interested in music, and we decided that while in China, we could speak Chinese, because I had lived there for a couple of years, Pete had lived there for a couple of years, so communication wasn't a problem. But once we got to all these other countries where we couldn't speak the language, we would need a way to communicate, you know, to kind of interact with people. And we decided that music would be a very effective way of interacting without language.
Yes, and I would call music the universal language.
Indeed.
Yes. That's going to be important for your paper on globalization. Music is an international language.
But everywhere we went, there were just crowds of people, especially when we played music, but just walking around the street. They're just people everywhere. You saw a lot of smiles, a lot of incredulity. You know what? People would think, well, what are five foreigners doing coming through this no-name town in China on their bicycles? People thought we were nuts, but they were still happy to see us for the most part. So China's been developing a lot economically, and we found that we had really good roads to bike on for the most part. And we would go through a big city like this often every 40 miles. You know, once a day we'd be going through a pretty big city, you know, as big as Billings. So for a person from Montana, it was a different experience. There were, of course, a lot of roads under construction as well, and there was dust everywhere. So, you know, you'd get done at the end of the day, go to blow your nose, and you just get a lot of unpleasant dark stuff coming out. Now, as part of our trip, we created a website. We called this website fueledbyrice.org. It's still up if you want to check it out. But another idea behind the trip was that we were going through Asia, and in a lot of the places we were going in Asia, people eat mostly rice. For us, as cyclists, rice was our fuel, hence the name Fueled by Rice. And we were also trying to express the fact that we weren't using petroleum products to move us across the land. And so, as it turns out, we were fueled by rice and by various vegetables and eggs and tofu. This woman in the pink here is one of our favorite chefs in China, because the food there is so cheap, we could eat at restaurants almost, you know, every day for every meal. And for all five of us to have as much as we could eat, it would only be about $4 or $5, so it was very cheap. And it was also a great way to interact with people along the way, because we could always talk with the cooks and the people preparing the food. So we had a good time in China, but then we reached the border with Vietnam, and we found that things were a little different. Because I had a small phrase book, but I couldn't speak Vietnamese. None of us could speak Vietnamese. We didn't know how much things should cost. We didn't know how to say really anything other than a few words. And so things were quite different. We still had nice roads because Vietnam, like China, is opening up economically and they're developing rapidly. But, you know, we still saw a lot of manual agriculture. And there's a saying in Vietnam, or in Southeast Asia in general, and it goes something like, the Laotians plant the rice, the Cambodians harvest the rice, and the Vietnamese sell the rice. And basically what that means is the people from Laos do a lot of the work, but don't get hardly any of the credit. The Cambodians get a little bit of the credit, but the Vietnamese get all the profit because they are very crafty and clever. And indeed, we found this to be the case because we would sometimes eat at a restaurant, we'd agree on a price, but then come time to pay the bill, the boss of the restaurant would charge us three times what we had agreed upon. So this led to several interesting situations, especially because we couldn't speak any Vietnamese. But, you know, we did our best to communicate with gestures and sad facial expressions sometimes. And we managed to work through the problems. But it wasn't that way with everyone. We found a lot of nice people in Vietnam. These folks invited us into their home to sleep one night. They were just some rural farmers with some fish ponds. And it was kind of a stormy night, and we were biking around aimlessly looking for a campsite. And I think the woman of the house saw Nakia, and her heart was moved by pity because here was a fellow woman out in the cold. And so she went up and talked to Nakia, and eventually we got invited back into their house. And her husband took us out on the fish pond, and we managed to net some fish for dinner. And so it was a really great experience and evidence of the fact that not everyone in Vietnam is out to cheat. Another night in Vietnam, we were out camping in the woods, kind of close to a village, and we had set up the tent, we'd eaten dinner, we had a nice fire going, and suddenly we're inundated by 20 or 30 people. And we thought, oh my gosh, what the heck is going on? Because we had villagers, we had policemen, we had soldiers, we had officers. We didn't know what was going on. But these folks eventually explained to us that we couldn't camp here. And we thought, oh gosh, this is awful. They're going to make us go to a hotel and we'll have to pay a lot of money. But instead, they brought us to a village meeting hall where we are in this photo. And they told us, okay, sleep in here. It's much safer. So we thought, well, fine. And we took full advantage of the premise, and we are here brushing our teeth with a photo of Ho Chi Minh. Let's see. The next country we came to was Laos. In Laos, we found wonderful forests. Because in China, we, in Vietnam, all of the really big trees had already been logged out because of the Cultural Revolution and just the logging policies implemented by China and Vietnam. But in Laos, which is very undeveloped, we found a lot of really pristine forests with huge trees. So it was really nice to be in a really nicely forested area and to see some of those old growth forests. Once we got to Cambodia, we had the good fortune to join the Mekong for a while. And the Mekong, of course, is the major river in Southeast Asia. And so we always had a nice place to camp every night. And after biking all day in the heat, it was nice to have a place to bathe every night, too. Because otherwise, you have to go to bed stinky. And there were a lot of nice views. We found in Cambodia that there were a lot of monks, a lot of Buddhist monks and monasteries along our way. And if we couldn't find a place to stay at night, we could always depend on going up to a monastery, talking with the monks, and they were always very hospitable, and we could always come in and set up our tent on the monastery grounds. So that was a different kind of beauty, I guess, to sleep around. But a lot of these temples are very ornately decorated. This is a house in Cambodia that we wound up staying at. You can see that it's elevated very much above the ground. You know, this looks like a second story, but actually it's a house that's on stilts. And the reason they put the house on stilts is that in the rainy season, they get a lot of water that builds up. And so if they had the houses on the ground level, they wouldn't, you know, they'd be full of water. So they have to put these houses on big stilts. And you look at a house on stilts and you don't think it's very nice. But actually, you come into this house, it's big and very well furnished. So it was a bit of a surprise. This complex is called Angkor Wat. It's one of the most famous archaeological sites in Southeast Asia. It was built by the Khmer people sometime between 1200 and 1300 AD. And after the Khmer civilization collapsed, it was basically lost in the jungle. And so it got completely overgrown with trees until it was found again in the late 1800s, and now it's an open tourist site.
In Machu Picchu.
Yeah. It's just, you know, a lot of amazing stonework. So it was a great place to visit for the most part. But we usually try to avoid tourist places on our trip. And that's just because people who see a lot of tourists tend to look at foreigners as money bags and just people to exploit for their income. And in the case of this little girl, we found ourselves confronted with something of this dilemma. You know, she's very young, probably about 10 or 11, but she's not in school. Instead of going to school, she sells trinkets and postcards to tourists who come to Angkor Wat. And she has a pretty good little spiel. She can count to 10 in about 7 different languages. So she would come up to you with these postcards and say, look, I have 10 postcards. I count for you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Under 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. She can do it much better than I can. But she's a very clever little girl, and we found ourselves wondering, though, is it better for her to be selling things to tourists and being able to maybe work in her English a little bit and earn a little money to improve her stake in life, or, you know, would she be better off going to school and getting an education? You know, unfortunately, a lot of these kids don't have the opportunities to go to school like you find here in the U.S. So, you know, we didn't really know what the best situation was for that little girl.
By the way, Jim, sometime maybe this week, they're going to bring 3 cups of tea.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. So, we finished with Cambodia. We got to Thailand. And does anyone know what country you have to go through between Thailand to get to India? Yes, Burma. So we had wanted to go to Burma, to Myanmar, as it's called now. Unfortunately, the border between Burma and Thailand, and Burma and India is closed. So if we had wanted to go from Thailand to India, we would have had to sneak through Burma, which of course is illegal and probably would have got us thrown in jail once we got to India. We didn't really want to go to jail, so instead we took a flight from Bangkok, Thailand to Calcutta, India, which is in the east of India. Getting to Calcutta was a shock because we saw way more people than we had seen in China. There's just people everywhere. And while India is also developing, it's doing so at a slower rate than China. And so you see a lot more older vehicles, a lot more shabby surroundings than you would in China, and a lot of older forms of transportation. I think Calcutta is the only city in the world where they still have these man-powered rickshaws. But the streets, once again, were just crowded with people and bikers and goats, camels, and just people everywhere. But we did find, once we got to the countryside, the roads opened up a little bit and they weren't so crowded, so we really enjoyed the space again once we got out of the city. This is a friend of mine from college. He was living a little bit north of Calcutta, and so we had an opportunity to come by his village and talk with him and stay in his village a few days. He's working at an educational institute, but it's in the middle of the countryside, so every time we went out, we'd get mobbed by these groups of very excited school children who would follow us around. We spent a little bit of time at the school where my friend worked, trying to give some music lessons, and we even put on a concert for the village. And so one night they set up a bunch of lights in front of the place where we were staying in a little stage, and we had a large group of Indians. They put all the children up front, and kind of the women sat behind the children, and then all the guys were kind of lurking in the background looking cool, but you could tell that they were still interested. And so Brian, my friend, played some classic Indian songs that he had learned, and then we played some more American-type songs, and so it was a great little exchange that we had for the night. This is a wedding, believe it or not. It's unlike the U.S., it's much more acceptable for the bride and groom to look serious at their wedding.
Is it a Hindu wedding?
Brian was actually in a Muslim village. So this is a Muslim wedding. And it kind of represents one of the things Brian was trying to combat while he was working at this school. Because in the case of this couple, the girl was pulled out of school several years before. Now she's about 16. So she was pulled out of school at 12 or 13. So that her family could save up for the dowry to get her married off. So, of course, she lost out on a lot of opportunity in order to have this traditional arranged marriage with this guy and, you know, kind of start her life early. And I think you'll read about similar struggles that Greg Mortensen is having in Pakistan when you read Three Cups of Tea. So that's something. This is a Muslim couple, but this does happen a lot with Hindus, and I think you'll find in almost every place where the economy is not so great and the area is not so developed. So we had a great time in Brian's village, but and then we continued through the rest of India, and it once we got to India, it was starting to get pretty darn hot. You know, we'd be biking through 90-degree temperatures. So you can imagine at the end of the day, it was really nice to be able to wash ourselves off. And luckily, they have a plethora of pumps in these little Indian villages. So we just stop, go up to one of these hand pumps that you pump, you know, just like you find at a campground here or something like that. And it's pretty standard for men in India to just bathe out on the street. That was lucky for us guys, because we could just kind of strip down to our skivvies and splash water on ourselves, just as these guys are doing here. But, of course, it's kind of an odd experience, because we'd attract a lot of attention, and so we'd be bathing for a crowd of, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 people. So that was a little strange. But one time we were approached by this gentleman, and he said, what are you doing? And we were like, well, we're bathing. What does it look like we're doing? And he said, well, this is a terrible place to bathe. You know, we were out in the street. A lot of people were watching us. He said, why don't you come back to my place and bathe? So we're like, well, sure, why not? So we followed those two gentlemen back to their home, and it wound up being kind of an upper middle class home in India. So it was in a gated community, and the interior was very clean, and everything was very quiet, quite dissimilar from what we had found outside on the common streets. And the guy wound up asking us to spend the night too, so we had a very pleasant evening with him and a very nice quiet place to sleep. So it was much better than our tent, which at that time was getting inundated with mosquitoes, which is a terrible thing to have happen. But kind of halfway through our trek through India, we found that we could go through Nepal and kind of cut up parallel with the entire country of Nepal. And so we decided, well, why not add another country to the list and see what Nepal is like? And at this time, we were getting a little bored with the nice paved road. So we decided to try to take back roads to Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal. And we found these roads were a little rough and a little hilly, and sometimes even impassable by bike. But there were a lot of nice areas to see. And Nepal is one of the few countries we went through that had had significant problems with stability soon, soon before we had gone through there. And so we saw a lot of things like this, where there's a lot of barbed wire surrounding these military installations. And what had happened in Nepal is all through the 90s, there was a large-scale Marxist rebellion, a Maoist rebellion, which you don't hear about too often nowadays, but a lot of the poor people from the countryside were joining or being forced to join this military insurrection, and then these Maoists would attack military fortifications that were held by the Nepali government. And just before we got into Nepal, they declared a ceasefire and held elections. And the Maoists had actually won the elections. So of course this marks a big change in Nepal. They kicked out the king, and now they had a fully functional, well, you know, who knows if it would be a fully functional democracy or not. So it was very much in transition. One of the most interesting homestays we had in Nepal happened just a couple days after we'd gotten into the country. We were asked to come and stay at a church by a couple guys when we were eating dinner. So we followed these guys back to their church, and we arrived at this complex, which is full of these very odd-looking huts because they're all built of bamboo. And you don't see that too often in Nepal. And these huts were just packed together in this huge community. And come to find out, these folks are living at a refugee camp. And they weren't Nepali at all. Only ethnically Nepali, but they were actually from Bhutan. But in the early 80s, they were kicked out of Bhutan because they were agitating for rights. As, you know, they wanted to speak their own language, they wanted to write their own language, but the Bhutanese were having nothing of this, so they were kicked out, and they've been living in this refugee camp, a lot of them, for almost 30 years. So a lot of the kids had grown up in this refugee camp. But, you know, we found that they were quite happy and very giving, despite the fact that they were living in, you know, not extreme poverty, but they were living in these very airy temporary houses, and they actually had us all sleep in their bed, in their beds. You know, they, I don't know where they slept, probably on the floor somewhere, but they gave us their entire bedroom. And so we had a nice place to sleep for the night. But I would wake up during the night, and I remember hearing all throughout the night, you know, you could hear people whispering, you know, a baby crying, an old woman coughing. But these houses were so close together, and as you can see, the walls were not at all soundproof. And so just you get tons of sound coming in throughout the night. So it was a pretty crazy experience. Okay, after Western India, we had to decide, should we go through Pakistan, Iran, to get to Turkey, or do we have to figure out an alternative? We were worried a little bit about the safety in Pakistan because there were a lot of bombings, a few kidnappings before we would go in there. But it turns out for Americans to go to Iran, it takes a lot of money and a lot of time to wait for the visa. And we didn't have too much money left at that time, and we also didn't have a lot of time to wait for the visa. So we decided to fly again. Our goal had been to get to Paris, and so we decided to fly over Pakistan and Iran and take a flight from Western India to Istanbul, Turkey, so that we could proceed with the journey. And we got to Turkey, and we found that the people were quite nice, but it marked kind of a big change for us, because we found that in Asia we would play music just to interact with people a little bit more. You know, we would never think of trying to earn money from playing on the street. But turns out in Istanbul, which is a very European city, there is a big tradition of street musicians performing for money. And a lot of the people we met told us, oh, you gotta go out on this one street and play and you'll make a lot of money. We thought, well, you know, why not? Our bank accounts are looking more and more pathetic all the time, so why not try to earn a little money on the street? And we tried it, and by gosh, I think we made about $300 or $400 in, you know, about two or three days. So it was a pretty lucrative undertaking. And, you know, the Turkish architecture is really amazing. So we had a good time in Istanbul going around, seeing all these sites. Yes. Yes. And I'm sure you'll hear about that later. But there are also a lot of mosques. Turkey is the first majority Muslim country we went to, and so every as you probably know, according to Muslim rules, there is a call to prayer 5 times a day, and so it became very pleasant and almost reassuring to hear this very mellifluous call to prayer being sung out from these minarets every every few hours or so. The people in Turkey were really great. This is Fatih. He's a guy who just came up to us on the streets in Istanbul, introduced himself to us, and before we knew it, he had taken us back to his house, cooked us dinner, invited us over to spend the night, and he was one of our biggest fans in Turkey, and was one of the key people who got us to go out and play music on the street.
My experience is that the Turks are probably the most hospitable people in the world.
Yeah, that was our experience as well. I mean, people would be, farmers would see us biking down the road and they'd wave at us and come running madly. We thought, my gosh, what are they doing? And they'd just be bringing us vegetables to eat, you know, for lunch or something. And a couple times we'd stop on street corners and I'd go off to ask directions. I'd come back and find that all my friends had been given cups of tea by the old men sitting in the tea stands along the side of the road. So it was a really great experience. And one of the craziest things that happened is we were biking along. It got to the end of the day and we came to this town, but it was surrounded by military bases. And you know, you don't want to try to camp by a military base because people get really paranoid when you're doing that around military bases. But we found this fire station. And I thought, well, you know, why not go and see if we can set up our tent in the fire station? So I went and asked, and, you know, they didn't speak any English, and we didn't really speak much Turkish, but these guys said, oh, yeah, they took our bikes in and put them next to the fire engines and brought us into their break room and gave us coffee and a little few treats and had a shower in their shower stall, and then they found a really nice place for us to stay as well. So it was just another experience of Turkish hospitality. Let's see. I might leave you with one story, depending on how long it takes me to get through this. But this is overlooking Belgrade, Serbia. Now, does anybody know what happened between the U.S. and Serbia in 1999? Anybody know? Kosovo? Ring a bell? Okay. So, in 1999, Serbia was accused of ethnic cleansing in the southern province of Kosovo. And it was a big international incident. And, you know, we tried to pressure the Serbs into pulling out of Kosovo, but they wouldn't do it. And so, President Clinton convinced NATO to start a bombing campaign in Serbia. And we bombed them for about 3 months, I believe. And during that time, you know, hundreds of Serbs were killed in collateral damage. And a lot of the infrastructure in Serbia was destroyed as well. And some of this you can still see today. This is the former army headquarters in Belgrade. But we stayed in Serbia with a friend of ours that we'd met in China. She's Serb, and she had come back from being in China to live in Belgrade. So we stayed with her for a couple weeks, and she took us up to this hill that overlooks Belgrade. And she said, she was my age, so she said, when I was in high school, my friends and I, we'd come up to this hill and we would watch the bombing of Belgrade. And so they'd see the NATO and the U.S. airplanes coming in and dropping their bombs and see the big explosions. And then, you know, they'd go home, go to bed, and get up and go to school the next day. So it was quite remarkable, because this is the only country we went through that the U.S. had basically been at war with. And, you know, I didn't know how people would react to my being an American. You know, because I know that some people from Iraq come to the U.S. and are not treated very well because people think, oh, they're Iraqi, they must be the enemy. So, surely some people in Serbia, I thought, would think that of me. But, lo and behold, people were really friendly. Really friendly, once again. And,
I gotta ask very quickly, that was one of the things going through my mind as you were talking about traveling from Vietnam. Was there any vestiges of the war there, or anything of that nature?
We didn't see, you know, any destroyed buildings or anything. I think they have museums you can go to, but actually our first night in Vietnam, we were looking for a place to stay, and the small village we were in, there was this guy who had a little guest house, and so we went in, and it was basically his home, but he had a free room, so we were all staying in this one room. But up on the wall, he had a lot of pictures and certificates. And you look at the pictures, and without a doubt, this guy was a high-ranking Vietnamese officer in the North Vietnamese Army. And, you know, he was about 62. So, you know, that's, you know, he was clearly fighting the Americans in, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. But we had a really good experience with him, and you know, he's a very regimented sort of guy, but he was very helpful to us and very friendly. So yeah, I guess once again in Vietnam,
time is a great healer.
Yeah, and I guess in Serbia, you know, I don't quite know how to explain it, but it seems that, you know, that the Serbs were really great at, you know, a lot of them don't, of course they don't think the bombing should have happened, they think they were in the right, but they're very good at discriminating between the citizen and the government. So they weren't going to hold what they saw as the sins of the government against the citizen. So that was great for us, and we played in the streets in Serbia as well, and we also did fine. So they weren't holding too much against Americans.
4 minutes.
Okay, you know, I'll take questions if anybody has any. Yes. Yeah, we, in China, well, I guess our immediate concern was microbes and stuff in the water that can make us immediately sick there. You know, there's probably a lot of issues with fertilizers and heavy metals and stuff, but, you know, basically we just drank what we could get. In China, they have what they call kaishui. It's boiled water that everybody drinks, so it's perfectly safe, and we would just fill up our water bottles with that. But once we got to India, people were just drinking the tap water, which is kind of questionable, and we tried to drink it a little bit. Sometimes we'd get sick and sometimes we wouldn't, but we found that we could take our water bottles, put them in the sun on the back of our bikes for 3 to 4 hours, and just with the chemistry of the sunlight hitting the water, it'll purify it pretty well. So we had good luck with that. Yes?
What kind of instrument do you play?
I am the least musical of everyone who was on the trip, but I would play the drums a little bit, harmonica, you know, backup vocals. That's basically what I do. Yes.
What kind of bikes were you guys riding? Because you had a lot of terrain.
Yeah, we had really a huge variety of bikes. Pete had an old racing bike from the 80s, but it had strong touring wheels. I had a cross bike, so it's like a cross between a road bike and a mountain bike, and two of the other people had mountain bikes. So I mean, basically, so long as the bike has strong wheels and gears, you can really make anything work in terms of
touring. Did you average distance bikes?
Let's see, we were aiming for 70 to 80 kilometers a day, so that's probably, you know, 50 miles. Yes.
Did you ever get any criticism from just for being foreign?
Well, you know, We were talking to people a lot in China, you know, because we could speak a little Chinese. And people were very critical of the war in Iraq, not a big fan of Bush. But often, you know, I mean, they wouldn't really look at us and say, you American, why are you doing all of this? You know, they would direct that antipathy at the government rather than the individual. So I don't know. I think a couple times we got a little gruff from people, but for the most part, people were pretty considerate. Yes?
How long was that
relationship? That's important information. It was about 14 months. So we started September 2007, and we ended in November of 2008. Yeah.
Did you have to get passports and visas from all like different countries you had to go through?
Yeah, we all had passports to begin with, but then we actually had to add visa pages to the passports because we didn't have enough visa pages, and then you know, we just kind of played it by ear. We usually, as we went along, we'd stop at the capital city, you know. So we stopped in Hong Kong and got visas for Vietnam and Laos. The Cambodian visa we could get on the border, and then in Bangkok we got the Indian visa, the Nepali border visa we got on the border. So you just have to kind of research ahead and figure out where you're going to be and where you can get these visas. But yeah, that was something we had to keep an eye on.
All right, let's give him a hand. Thank you very much.